Minutes from the House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson. Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Not Dick Tracy, Mr. Chair, just a ray of sunshine.
Representative Mueller. Representative Mueller. Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang. Excused. Representative Zhang. Representative Zhang. Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Vang. Oh, Representative Zhang. That concludes roll call.
Very well, thank you. Members, a quorum is present. And just a quick reminder that this hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations in Response to the COVID-19 Infectious Disease Pandemic Requiring Public Health Exercise of Social Distancing. The public can go to the House website to view House Rule 10.01, as well as to visit the committee page, the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Committee page, for instructions on how to access this and other hearings via streaming video, as well as instructions for participating in public testimony. First order of business would be adoption of our minutes. I'm wondering, Representative Cleavorn, I'm going to spring this on you without letting you know, if you would be so kind as to move the minutes of February 19th, yes, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the minutes to be adopted as written for February 19th.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Representative Cleavorn moves adoption of the minutes from February 19th. Discussion. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And the minutes for this committee from February 19th are hereby adopted and will be posted. Thank you, members. Members, today we have four bills. We really technically have two bills. Well, not technically, really have two bills. Technically, we have four bills. And I'll explain this in a second. We also have quite a few testifiers lined up, and so I'm going to make my pitch right now early. Hopefully all the testifiers are listening. That being very concise is going to be very helpful. I do want to do everything I can to make sure that members can weigh in with questions and thoughts. I also want to make sure that all testifiers get a chance to offer their advice for us. The first bill is House File 1152, Representative Long. We're going to be moving to lay that over, but we are going to have hopefully a good discussion explaining the bill and then a conversation about it. The second bill, House File 9, with Representative Greenman, we're going to move that bill. Well, there'll be a motion to move that bill, better said. And then, members, the next two bills are actually are bills that have very distinct separate provisions from House File 9. And the chair's intent is to move those bills as well. It is my hope that we don't need to spend a whole lot of time on those bills because we will be covering the exact content, subject matter and content within House File 9. So I'll be asking the author of House File 9 as well as testifiers to pay close attention to identifying those elements so we can be as efficient as possible. There's going to be some other instructions related to House File 9, but I'll get to that when we get to the bill. So members, with that, Representative Long moves to refer House File 1152 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Long, your bill is before us.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Happy Second Chance Day.
Yes.
The Clean Slate Act, House File 1152, has a simple premise. We should give those who have served their time an opportunity for redemption. Too often, having a criminal record severely limits an individual's opportunities to find jobs, housing, or education. I've heard many moving stories from my constituents who are trying to turn their lives around but can't find an apartment even years after they've completed their sentence or are struggling to find a job. And they're not alone. One in four Minnesotans have some type of criminal record. 90% of employers conduct background checks. 80% of landlords conduct background checks. And 60% of colleges conduct background checks. This bill builds on the leadership many of our county attorneys are currently showing in expunging old records. But this work is time intensive, and not all counties have the same resources to pursue it. The Clean Slate Act would automatically expunge records for certain low-level misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and a limited list of felonies after the conditions of sentence and a crime-free waiting period pass. It would apply to juvenile dispositions as well. It builds on broad bipartisan efforts we've seen in recent years in states like Pennsylvania, Utah, and Michigan. To date, under Pennsylvania's law, 36,000 records have been expunged, opening many new doors of opportunities. And in Michigan, those who've had their records expunged saw their average wages increase a remarkable 25%. I'd like to thank Representative Garofalo for being a co-author on the bill and the broad support we have for the bill. And to try to limit my time and make sure we can get through everybody, I'll turn it over to my testifiers. We have six testifiers, and I'll ask each to be brief because I know our time is limited today. And first, we have County Attorney Choi.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Long. I can't think of too many bills more important than this for this committee as well as for our state. And I think part of that is witnessed too by the bipartisan nature of this bill. So thank you for that. County Attorney Choi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it's great to see you and all of you members of the committee. And first of all, I want to thank Representative Long for his leadership and collaboration of bringing people together to put together a really important a bill, as people have mentioned here. I am John Choi, the Ramsey County Attorney, and I'm speaking today on behalf of all Minnesota County Attorneys as a part of the association. We recently took a vote on this bill, and unanimously we support this legislation. But I want to tell you a little bit about the process of how this all came together. Since this summer, we have had a working group of county attorneys from all over the state of Minnesota. And you'll hear from Cook County Attorney Molly Hicken, Candio, and then we also had Candio High County Attorney Shane Baker, Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom and his staff, St. Louis County Attorney Mark Rubin, Crow Wing County Attorney Don Ryan, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman and his staff, and Washington County Pete Orbit, we had numerous meetings throughout the summer and the fall to really go over all of the details in this bill, to ensure that we did right by the victims, right, to ensure that what we were doing would actually be workable. And also, too, it's informed by the practice that we started back in October of 2019, where we started doing prosecutor-initiated expungements. And I want to make it clear for this committee and the public that expungements only mean that we seal the record. And as we know, what has happened with the proliferation of records, it's difficult for people to escape the collateral consequences of criminal convictions. And it's been a barrier to a whole host of things. And as county attorneys across the state, we recognize that we have to stop punishing people once they have done everything that we have asked them to do. And as a part of the work that we have been doing in prosecutor-initiated expungement since October of 2019, the first thing I can tell you is it shouldn't have to be this hard. We know that other states have put into place some way to automatically think about people who have been diverted, misdemeanor-level offenses, gross misdemeanors, and low-level felonies. And this bill will allow for that, and it will be done in an equitable way because we know that people typically aren't going to necessarily know that these processes are available to them. And so by doing this, you are improving and enhancing the quality of justice across the state. You will have people will have better access to our economy. And so I just want to thank all of you for your consideration. This is one of the top priorities of county attorneys, and you'll hear from some of my colleagues here shortly. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you, County Attorney Choi, and thank you for your effort along with all your colleagues. This has been a primary interest to you and your colleagues for a number of years, and I'm really glad to see the product come forward in the quality way that it has. Next, members, we have Molly Hicken, Cook County Attorney. Welcome to the committee. Now, County Attorney Hicken, please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
My name is Molly Hicken, Cook County Attorney. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. Cook County includes Grand Marais and Lutzen, and we are neighbors to the reservation governed by the Grand Portage Anishinaabe. HF 1152 is going to be a benefit to the people of Cook County and to many people in rural and outstate Minnesota. Incomes are on average lower here, and we need automatic expungement of certain crimes to increase equal access to the relief that expungement provides. The large scope of data, which is currently publicly available about people's interactions with criminal justice, really invites the improper and unfair use of that information. To essentially increase penalties against people beyond what the legislature set, as criminal penalties for these offenses. What I like about this bill is that it will limit the opportunities to misuse criminal records for improper purposes, but it will actually potentially improve access to expunged records by law enforcement and by county attorney's offices for legitimate purposes. I also share the concern that there are historically over-policed neighborhoods and communities across the state whose members have experienced disparate negative impacts by arrests and convictions. And in rural Minnesota, these are often reservations and poor neighborhoods. This bill can begin to chip away at the continuing effects of historic injustices in policing and criminal courts. Several years ago, I was asked to assist a local resident with an expungement, and this man was known to our office, not as a criminal defendant, but as an EMT who had assisted after a shooting in our courthouse in 2011. He was in his 60s, and he had been convicted of this crime when he was 18. And one random day, after decades of crossing the Canadian border to fish and to shop, he was suddenly refused entry. On this random day, the border guards had discovered this man's perjury conviction from the 1970s and turned him away. His RV was sitting at a repair shop in Ontario waiting for him to pick it up. So the use of a public criminal record can be arbitrary and nonsensical, not to mention seemingly perpetual in some cases. And we cannot in one bill fix all of the inappropriate collateral consequences that people face because of minor criminal convictions, but we can do our part in this bill to limit the number and types of records that are publicly available, seemingly in perpetuity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hickens. I appreciate your testimony and for painting a picture of what the reality is in parts of the state that people like me don't live in and don't visit, but yet we're responsible for, and it's important for us to understand the realities on the ground there. Thank you. Next, we have my good friend, Michael Freeman, who's Hennepin County Attorney. Welcome to the committee, County Attorney Freeman.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, it's great to be back at the legislature, even if it's only remotely. I commend you all for doing such great public service. I know you miss the interaction that those of us who were privileged to serve in live time had when we were in the legislature. I want to commend Representative Long for his perseverance in putting this together. The unanimous support of the County Attorneys Association is not easily accomplished, and I know that County Attorney Higgins and County Attorney Choi had a lot to do with that, and I had a small part as well. But we're excited about this for all the reasons they both have testified to. We here in Hennepin County already do expungement for diversion cases, both pre-charge and post-charge diversion, adult and juvenile. But we find that this bill that Representative Long is bringing is broader and deeper and also eliminates some of the roadblocks. For all the reasons people have suggested, you've done your time, you're completed the requirements that the law has imposed upon you, and you ought to be able to go forward with your life without this limitation in terms of jobs, in terms of housing, in terms of just moving forward in life. And I know that the chair and others have supported restoring the vote as well when your time is done. And I know that is not this bill, but this is a good step trying to reduce the limitations after a person has done his time and being able to move forward in a progressive and positive way. So I will be uncharacteristically brief, Mr. Chair, but I enthusiastically endorse this. And Jamie, take it away. Let's get her done. Thank you.
Thank you, County Attorney Freeman, and thank you for your pioneering work in Hennepin County with at least some aspects of what we have before us. Next, we have Jonathan Weinhagen, Minneapolis Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Weinhagen, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having me. My name is Jonathan Weinhagen. I'm the president and CEO of the Minneapolis Regional Chamber. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1152, the Clean Slate Act. As an organization representing nearly 2,300 employers across the greater metropolitan region, we know the importance of having trained and skilled workers given the worker shortage in certain fields. We believe this legislation will help provide a pathway for workers to fill this void. Unfortunately, there are far too many barriers for individuals with criminal records who seek to better their lives but face barriers in education, housing, and employment. According to the Brennan Center, the number of Americans with a criminal history has increased significantly over the past three decades. Today, nearly one-third of working adults have a criminal background. Our country now roughly has the same number of people with criminal records as we do with those with a college degree. These numbers do not include people who were arrested but never charged or individuals who were acquitted. As we look to our workforce in the next decade, employers are going to need trained and skilled workers. We'll continue to have a shortage even in a post-COVID era, and I know that we all aspire to be in that time as soon as possible. This bill will allow a pathway for individuals to receive automatic expungement for certain convictions while still maintaining public safety access to those records. This will make an enormous difference for individuals who are seeking to enroll in post-secondary education options, training programs, obtain occupational licenses, and secure housing. Thank you for the opportunity to provide my testimony in support of the Clean Slate Act today.
Thank you, Mr. Weinhagen. I have to say I was stunned with the data that you just shared about the numbers of people with criminal records relative to those with post-secondary degrees and credentials. That's just stunning. On a lighter note, let me ask you, one of my most venerable businesses in my district is Weinhagen Tire. I patronized them for decades. Any relation?
I'm a fourth generation family member.
How about that? Wow. Well, your family has been just a bedrock institution in St. Paul and on the West Side. Just giving a brief shout out to you all.
Thank you.
Very well. Josh Esme with the Legal Rights Center. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Esme. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Josh Esme. I'm a defense attorney, a lawyer at the Legal Rights Center, which is a nonprofit public defense corporation under state law where We represent indigent clients in criminal court. And I want to share, I first want to thank Representative Long and everyone who's worked so hard on this bill, including the County Attorneys Association. I think the Clean Slate Act is a really great bill, and I'm here to testify in support of it. And I want to share sort of the perspective of the practitioner. Back in 2012, I started getting involved in a number of legal clinics being put on by then the Council on Crime and Justice and the Volunteer Lawyers Network that were sort of set up to address really a significant unmet need for helping people who have the criminal records and are suffering the burden of those criminal records with legal advice and legal assistance. There's not a whole lot of places for people in that situation to get help. The public defenders do everything they can, I know, but this work is beyond their scope. You can hire a private attorney, but we're talking about thousands of dollars in fees. And the majority of people who are facing this barrier are facing it because they're underemployed or unemployed because of the collateral consequences for this record. And so back in 2012, we started these clinics, and one in particular that I want to talk about is one that we've been putting on once a month called Second Chance Saturday. In the last couple of years, we've really started using this clinic as a place to provide document drafting help and sort of assisted pro se help. And the reason we've done this is we saw, you know, watching what was happening with the decisions and expungement hearings, we're able to identify a number of types of cases where there's a pattern where, you know, this type of charge is going to be able to get expunged. We have pretty high confidence that a prosecutor is not going to object. But nevertheless, there was still this major barrier in terms of getting the work done, getting the petition drafted, going through all the pretty complicated steps to file it properly and give notice to the dozens of agencies that you need to give notice to in order to obtain the expungement. And so we really started identifying cases where that was sort of the level of help that was needed, not a ton of advocacy, just the technical help of doing this work to get the petition filed. And we've just seen, prior to the pandemic, which has kind of put everything on hold, we just saw a tremendous turnout at that clinic, often more than we were able to help in a single day. And the people that were coming to that clinic, I mean, it's what you'd think. It's employment problems. It's housing problems. It's, you know, struggling to meet the bare necessities of life. Because of the barriers that these records are in place. Representative Long mentioned in Michigan, they saw a 25% increase in wages for people who got expungements. I'm aware of another study out of California that that showed about a $6,000 annual increase in wages for people who are successfully able to obtain an expungement. And I just got to say, you know, that's basically right in line with what I see from the clients in my clinic. And so I think, you know, members of the committee, you can be assured that if you pass this bill, real good will come of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Asme, and thank you for, accenting one of the points that Mr. Weinhagen made earlier in terms of a positive impact on our community through economic opportunity. And also thank you for raising the issue of the cost. I meant to highlight that quickly when County Attorney Higgin spoke in greater Minnesota, where incomes tend to be lower, that becomes an even bigger challenge as we look at, you know, the costs that are associated. And then, of course, just the multiple inquiry and steps taken that you described as well. So thank you for painting that that picture of reality for us. We have Jason Flores from Americans for Prosperity. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Flores. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jason Flores. I'm the state director for Americans for Prosperity here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 1152, the Clean Slate Act, which would provide for the sealing of criminal records for misdemeanors and charges not leading to convictions. This bill is a step in the right direction toward eliminating the collateral consequences within the criminal justice system. All criminals should be held accountable for their actions, and punishments should be proportional to the crime committed. And then, after being held accountable, an individual should be allowed to put his or her life back together. Too often, dated and irrelevant criminal records prevent people from obtaining jobs and productively re-entering a community once they have served their sentence. Even when they reflect low-level crimes or charges that did not result in conviction, these records impose serious barriers to opportunity in the workplace and in everyday life. Across the country, criminal justice reform has proven to be a winning issue that attracts widespread support from the voting public and unites lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. Both the Utah and Pennsylvania cases mentioned before, they've passed similar forms of this bill, and they did so under conservative leadership and with broad bipartisan support. Following on the heels of the First Step Act, monumental federal justice reform, this passage of the Clean Slate Act will put Minnesota on the right track toward lasting criminal justice reform that promotes human dignity, reduces costs to taxpayers, and enhances public safety. We cannot allow individuals who seek out and work for a second chance to be defined and held back by their worst mistakes in life. With an irascible criminal record, they are, in effect, locked out of the American dream. And that is why these reforms are so important. Thanks again for your leadership on this. Thanks again to Representative Long. Be happy to stick around for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Flores. Thank you to your national organizations, America for Prosperity, for being a beacon of common sense and, you know, human decency, quite frankly, when it comes to this and many, many other issues as well. Thank you. And then we have I hope I pronounced the name correctly, from All Square, Terrian Gill, if you can come forward, state your name for the record and give us your testimony, that'd be great. You may be muted. Okay, well, let's give Terrian a minute to sort out the technical stuff. And in the meantime, we have in addition to the author's testifiers, we have a public testimony from Gloria Perez, President and CEO of the Women's Foundation. Ms. Perez, if you can come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it. And that doesn't seem to be happening either. We'll have staff sort that out. And as soon as we can get these two individuals in, we will. But in the meantime, we can certainly move to questions. So I do have one question with or two hands up. Let me start, Representative Long. Something Mr. Weinhagen said, and I had forgotten about it before, is that the expungement process does not mean that public safety cannot have access to the record. And so if you can speak to that issue quickly, and then, you know, quite frankly, it'd be good if you can just do a big, you know, just walk through of the main features of the bill as well, because we jump right into testimony. And so if you can answer that question quickly and do that, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that's correct. The bill keeps the current expungement framework, which is really record sealing for public purposes, but the records would remain available for law enforcement and for example, the Department of Human Services or others that require access to those records for sensitive employment purposes. So none of that would be changed from current law. And I did do a very brief walkthrough of the bill in my introduction. So it's not particularly complicated, and hopefully I summarized for members that this would provide for automatic expungement for certain listed crimes after certain periods of time for individuals who have not committed another crime in that period and who have completed their terms of their sentence.
All right. Well, that is a brief walkthrough. Very well. Let's just jump into questions. Representative Devani, followed by Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Two questions for the author, Representative Long. First of all, I don't read the language where it's just the public records. Is there some delineation or some line that you could point me to where it shows that the record's still sealed from public viewing, but available as far as a criminal history or record check goes that way?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Representative Von Eads. That's current law, so we're not changing the current law approach to to how expunged records are dealt with. But if you had further questions, I might defer to our nonpartisan staff.
Representative Otten.
And thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Wong, so said the thought is a good thought. We just testified in, or we just had testimony earlier today in judiciary on eliminating criminal background records from people from a long time ago. And as I testified in judiciary, it's, you know, this is America. We're all about second chances and moving on. And you know, if you make a mistake when you're young, getting, you know, past that, we understand that the list of excluded crimes up into the felonies is still pretty extensive. You know, there's a laundry list of you know, DUIs, the assaults, burglaries, indecent exposures, all these things. Which crimes are we really solving here? When you take the big chunk of these crimes out, I suspect we're not really talking about that many cases. So what is the, what's the motivation for this on a lot of these cases?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good question. A number of the crimes that are removed from automatic expungement are because they're for enhanceable offenses. So down the road, that they could be used to enhance a sentence. And so they tend to be crimes of violence, DWI, and sexual assault related. It is a long list, but I assure you the list of misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors that aren't in the bill is much, much longer in terms of the crimes that are eligible for automatic expungement. And we were trying to strike the appropriate balance, working closely with the county attorneys to make sure that we were not impeding their ability to have enhancements of penalties down the road when needed.
Representative Lottie.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Wong, that's where I'm confused, because we want to keep this available to public safety, but it's not there for enhancements. I'm kind of still confused by that. If we're going to keep these available for enhancements, are they expunged from the public and the private records or not?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I wasn't clear, Representative Botany. So the crimes that are not automatically expunged are those that need to be available for later enhancement. But if an individual wants to apply to a court for expungement, that route is still available to them. It's just for automatic expungement, as this bill lays out, we wouldn't do that for enhanceable offenses.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Abdi, for helping us to clarify that. Representative Grasso, followed by Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Long. I guess I was distracted a little bit there, but I was wondering about the stays of adjudication portion of it for criminal sex charges. Are those things that would be expunged?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So stays of adjudication would be, if there's a specific context, I might have to phone a friend. But the concept is that if you have not been convicted, that those records would be expungible at a later point.
Why don't we phone a friend, Representative Grasso, and perhaps one of our county attorneys?
County Attorney Choi, I might recommend that.
County Attorney Choi?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think Jorge Saavedra from our office, from my office, who helped work on the bill, could, I think, hone in on the specific question, Representative Grasso. So I'm going to invite Mr. Saavedra to turn on his camera, and there he is. Did you get the question?
I did.
Mr. Saavedra, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and if you want, we can have Representative Grasso restate the question as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jorge Saavedra, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney. And in response to the question, so a stay of adjudication, if an individual completes successfully the terms of the stay, that is, if they fulfill all of the conditions which result in that grant of a stay of adjudication. At the end of that stay period, then the offense is dismissed. And so in that case, the automatic expungement statute would function to expunge or seal that record. And again, I would just reiterate that despite the expungement, which is sealing the record remains accessible to prosecution and law enforcement.
And Mr. Chair,
thank you. Representative Long.
If I may add, it's also only for the eligible listed offenses in the bill.
Representative Gossett.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that is something that, you know, I'm looking at that and knowing that the legislation that I'm working on with the child pornography legislation, where a lot of those types of cases receive a stay for their sentence because of our current statute. So, you know, it's alarming because we have numerous cases throughout the state to where these people receive these stays and then go out and commit a more heinous act, increased type of violent crime against a child or a woman wherever they are. Even a case where there's a bus driver, because I had some legislation for to keep track of these types of offenders who have a stay of adjudication, who did admit to receive that deal on a stay of adjudication, who have come back and reoffended again. So I think to make sure that whatever is going to be expunged, narrow that scope, because these people, a lot of these offenders are flying under the radar and coming back and striking again, and even with even a worse crime.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grossel, if there's a felony criminal sexual conduct crime or child pornography crime, then that's excluded from the bill. If you're talking about a misdemeanor or a gross misdemeanor, I believe that we've done our best to scrub every criminal sexual conduct crime that is at the misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor level. If there's one you're aware of that we didn't catch, please let us know. But that certainly the bill is not intended to cover the crimes that you're concerned about.
So long. It's awfully important to get the intent of the author before us. So we will be laying this bill over. And so if we're discovering that we're not able to meet that intent for whatever reasons, we can still, work on this bill. And I suspect Representative Grossel would be willing to work with you on that as well.
Thank you, Representative Long. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grossel. Representative Johnson, followed by Representative O'Neill, then Representative Hollins, and then we're going to move because we need to get to the other bill. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Long, I understand the concept of this bill that you're putting forward, but I do have some concerns. One is, I'm just wondering if you've requested a fiscal note. I see there's a lot of things that BCA is going to be required to do. I guess the first question is that, do you have any idea how many people's records would be automatically expunged if we pass this right off the bat?
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the bill currently isn't retroactive, so it's looking forward to future crimes. So there would not be an automatic off of that expungement. A fiscal note has been requested. I know that they're still working through it, but my understanding is there will be some upfront costs to set up a software system to be able to do the automatic expungement from BCA, and then some pretty limited ongoing costs to be implementing the programs, but I don't have the specific numbers yet.
And we certainly have time. This is going to be laying this over if we move this in the omnibus bill for us to dig deeper into those finance costs. Representative Johnson.
Yeah. Reading the bill in subdivision 4, it just says the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension to identify eligible persons and grant expungement relief. And reading through it, it doesn't say it's from this time forward. Reading it the way it is currently written, it goes back and it looks like it's automatic expungement without even notification of the person. So I think that's something that needs to be looked at very carefully. because if they have to go back and expunge all those old records, you're talking hundreds of thousands of records. And that's going to be a huge bill for BCA. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Representative O'Neill, followed by Representative Hollins, and then we're going to move forward. Representative Long, I'm going to ask you after Representative Hollins to talk a bit about the author's amendment that you wanted to offer. It was out of order to offer it because of timing issues, but I think it's important for you to share quickly what the intent is there. Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair and members, so I was just on the website to see who were the co-authors and the Senate companion, and maybe it's not updated yet, but Representative Long, you're the only one listed as the author in the House, and there is no Senate companion. So my first question is that going to be coming, and do you have a Senate author? And my second question is, it's actually more of a concern. One of the testifiers said that this doesn't include felonies, but in fact, my notes show me that it includes 14 felonies. And I'm not going to list them all off, but I think some of them that are a bit of concern, just because of my background in, we're talking a lot about the criminal sexual conduct codes, statutes. And in my work with rape kits, it became very apparent that DNA is actually found in different places, not just in the rape kit, but the DNA, that same DNA is many times found in cases of burglary. And so you have on here a list of one of the many felonies, one of the 14 felonies listed is possession of burglary tools. So I personally have an issue with that because sometimes when someone is charged with burglary, they plead down to possession of the tools because it's harder to prove the actual burglary. And so that may not be on your radar, but I take issue with that particular thing in the new findings that we're finding with the rape kits that are being processed, that the DNA is actually found quite often in also burglary cases. So I take issue with that. I think that there's a few other felonies that, well, first of all, we had a testifier say that there were no felonies, and that's clearly not true. But if you would just speak to the process of how you figured out and decided on the 14 felonies that are actually included in the automatic expungement, that would be helpful. And let us know about other authors that you are going to have and why they're not listed today on the website. And if you have a Senate companion, thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Dion. Without any prejudice to your comments, because I think they're all very good questions, I do just for the record for the public want to remind the public and ourselves that this body certainly reserves for itself the absolute authority to move legislation regardless of what happens in the other body. Obviously, to get to a law, you got to get to agreement with the other body. Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, may I just?
Yeah. Representative O'Neill.
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I didn't say that for that reason, but it was the bill was presented like it had great support and bipartisan support, and when I looked at the website, that didn't pan out. So I'm just asking the author to explain.
Fair enough. Representative Long.
Thank you very much for the question, Representative O'Neill. The process is moving very quickly over here, and it's hard to get as many meetings as I'd like with the remote conversations, but I mentioned that Representative Pat Garofalo is a co-author of the bill. He's not listed on the website yet, but he asked to have his name added, and hopefully that will be reflected soon. And I've been having many conversations with folks in the House and in the Senate, and I'm confident that we will have more bipartisan authors added soon, including in the Senate. And as to the felony list, it is identical to the list of current eligible expungible felonies with two exceptions. And those are, you mentioned one of those, which is the possession of burglary theft tools. Those were suggestions that came to us from the County Attorneys Association, so I'm happy to let them speak to it, but I support both of adding both of those. They were, I thought, good recommendations from the county attorneys.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my concern is that this is automatic. And so with expungement now, it is there is a lot of checks and balances and there's deep dives. This is automatic. This regardless of, you know, the few conditions that you put in the bill, the expungement automatically happens. And I'm just concerned that that's not appropriate in all of these cases. And as you pointed out, two of the felonies are not currently listed as possibilities to be expunged in the current process. So I find that problematic, and particularly with the new information that has been kind of being unveiled with all of this DNA that's being processed, that it becomes even more problematic. So I will not be voting for this bill today for those reasons. It needs more work. I'm sorry, Representative Long, this bill needs more work.
Representative O'Neill, we will not be moving this bill today, so there's certainly going to be time for more work. Representative Long, do you want someone from the county attorneys to quickly weigh in on those two other felony provisions, or you want to just continue to work with?
Sure, no, that would be great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. That would be great. We'll be to invite someone to.
Perhaps Deputy County Attorney Saavedra.
Very well. Mr. Saavedra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically on those the suggested offenses that were added to the short list of felony violations that are eligible for automatic expungement, that really was a result of the experience of the various county attorneys across the state. And in our work group process, we scrubbed those offenses very carefully. And really focused in on low-level felonies where we see, and especially with the safeguards regarding the criminal history and any subsequent crimes, we see individuals that really are deserving of a second chance and some redemption here. In particular, what I would indicate is that, you know, for a typical low-level felony that's eligible for expungement, an individual may be on probation for anywhere from 3 to 5 years. There's an additional waiting period that applies afterwards. So in a typical felony, an individual has to maintain 10 consecutive crime-free years before that offense becomes eligible for expungement. And then going back to Representative McGrossel's question earlier regarding sex crime, I would add just that the county attorney's office considered a broad range of offenses, and sex crimes in particular received special scrutiny, and those were specifically excluded from automatic expungement eligibility in this bill.
Very well. To be continued, for sure. I do note earlier testimony from County Commissioner Choi that the language you have before us is enjoys unanimous support from the County Attorneys Association, which is an incredibly diverse group of people, both politically, geographically, et cetera. I know that, we have to ask the tough questions, but I just want to highlight that. Representative Hollins, then Representative Long, I'll have you comment on the author's amendment, and then we're going to move to the next bill. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I'll be very quick. So first of all, thank you, Representative Long, for bringing this forward. You will soon have another co-author. And I wanted to note that the bill is pretty obviously not retroactive. If you look at line 6.19 to 6.20, that being said, my question's really around why isn't this bill retroactive? I think it really gets to the heart of an important question about our criminal justice system. You know, do we want this to be purely punitive and to have lasting effects for the rest of folks' lives? Or are we looking at something where we want people to be able to be restored if they are willing to put in the work and become productive members of society? So I would love to know why it's not retroactive.
Fair question, Representative Long.
Thank you so much for the question, Representative Hollins, and thank you. I couldn't come up with the line in time, so I appreciate the assistance for answering Representative Johnson's question. I would support making the bill retroactive. The one of the reasons that we didn't is the cost and looking at the fiscal impact. I'm hopeful we can get the program started and then see what costs would be in the future for retroactivity. But at this point, that's not what we're proposing. And just while I have the floor, I'll just also mention really briefly to Representative O'Neill's question. If the concern is to DNA and to evidence there, then there's nothing in the bill that would expunge DNA or that would get rid of the ability for that its use in a future crime. It's really just the record of the crime itself that is sealed.
Good. That's an important point. I appreciate that. Representative Hollins?
No further questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I had the similar question. I mean, you often legislate in order to move things forward, and sometimes it's, steps, but it does concern me that we may have a universe where, folks are going to have access and others are not. And, what does that sort of set up in terms of, buy-in for, the reform, et cetera. But we'll take it one step at a time. Representative Long, if you could comment on your office amendment, and then we're going to lay your bill over and move on to the next bill. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The author's amendment was trying to make some technical corrections that the BCA had suggested to the bill, and then also to add one crime as an exemption that we had missed in the previous drafting. So it's a technical amendment, and I appreciate posting it. And when we bring the bill back, hopefully, then that'll be included. And I just want to thank everybody for their support and hard work on this broadly supported bill, and I'm really grateful for everyone's effort on it.
I agree, and I appreciate the conversation here. Committee, I thank you for bringing this bill forward. I look forward to us working on it again shortly. With that, I do want to thank all our testifiers today. Thank you. You were more than testifiers. Many of you were also actively involved in shaping the proposal before us, so thank you for that. With that, members, the chair will lay over House File 1152 for possible. Well, I'm just for layover. So with that, that's the chair will be laying over this bill. Thank you, Representative and Chair Vaughn. With that, members, we have House File 9, Representative Greenman. Welcome to the committee, Representative Greenman. I think this might be your first appearance before us, perhaps not. Representative Greenman, the chair will move to refer House File 9 to the Transportation Committee. And so, Representative Greenman, your bill is before us. And I think right off the bat, do you have an author's amendment you wish to us to act on at this point?
That's right, Mr. Chair, and it's nice to be here. It is my first time in front of this committee.
Also.
Yeah, it makes sense to do the author's amendment, I think, first.
Very well. So in order to put the bill in the shape the author has before us, the chair will move to amend House File 9 with the A-12 amendment. Any discussion? I think we can do this on a voice vote, if that's okay with you, Representative Johnson.
That is fine.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. All in favor of the of amending House File 9 with the author's amendment A-12, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevailed. House File 9 is amended. Representative Greenman, your bill covers broad areas, many of which are not within the jurisdiction of this committee, but some that are. It is my hope that you certainly want to understand what the bill is and what it does, we really focus our exploration of it and deliberation of it on those certain provisions that fall within the public safety jurisdictions. So as you tell us about the bill, if you can identify what those are for us. And then also, there will be, but I'm thinking they might be the same provisions. There will be two bills right after this that are going to move. Well, there will be a motion to move those bills of very certain provisions within this bill. And, members, part of this is because, this legislation is going to need to travel through several committees. And so the idea is to, once we vet it, certain provisions, that we can move those forward so they can continue to stand on their own and be vetted in other jurisdictions. And hopefully, I'll meet up on the floor at some point. I hope I'm not confusing folks, but I guess I'm giving you direction or some agreement in terms of, how we'll shape this conversation going forward. But please tell us about the bill, and then we'll you've got a strong second here with Representative Frazier, who's working on this bill. So maybe both of you telling us about the bill. I'll let you all tag team on that. And then we have a rich group of testifiers that we wish to hear from as well. Representative Greenman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I am both going to keep it brief and take a minute after I just described the reason for the bill, take a minute to let Ben Johnson run through the very specific provisions so House Research can make sure that the committee is informed of what we're looking at. I'm really grateful to be here talking about House 9, the Democracy for the People Act, which, as Chair Mariani mentioned, includes language from House File 876, Representative Frazier's bill, and also similar provisions to to House File 662, Representative Long's bill. The bill defends and strengthens Minnesota's best traditions of an inclusive, participatory democracy, transparency in government, and grassroots campaigns. And it rests on the simple premise that our state works best when the voices of all Minnesotans are at the center of our democracy. When Minnesotans, Black, Brown, Indigenous, White, Metro and Greater Minnesota, new voters, longtime voters, voters returning from incarceration, when Minnesotans power our democracy. So again, I'm going to just start with the reasons and sort of the background of the bill. This year, our democracy was tested in pretty unimaginable ways. We conducted a presidential election during a global pandemic with, like in other policy areas, the pandemic exposed the inequities, the inefficiencies, some of the things that we need to fix. We also saw our democracy tested by a rising climate of disinformation, rhetoric, and fear. Here in Minnesota, we saw an out-of-state security firm, Atlas Aegis, reportedly recruiting armed security contractors to come to Minneapolis to be armed and on guard, raising fears of voters and election judges, and especially our neighborhoods and our neighbors in the BIPOC and immigrant communities. The good work of the Attorney General's office was able to stop them from coming, but the threats, the intimidations, and that our elections officials and that our voters have been feeling, that's on the rise. And just 6 weeks ago, we witnessed the dangerous consequences of the rise of disinformation and harassment targeting our elections. This election also highlighted the problems that Minnesotans have been asking the legislature to tackle for years, starting with the disenfranchisement of the 55,000 Minnesotans with felony convictions who are living and working in our communities and should have a voice in our democracy and in our policymaking. It responds to the urgent and the overdue. It defends the right to vote with strong provisions to protect voters, elections officials, and election volunteers. It strengthens the right to vote by restoring the right to vote for tens of thousands of Minnesotans on probation and parole, by improving access to voter registration and to the ballot for every Minnesotan, no matter where they live, what their background is, or how they cast their ballot, and ensures that we draw our districts fair and transparently and ensure that people are represented at their homes and their communities where they permanently reside, not where they're incarcerated. It puts Minnesotans at the center of our democracy and ensures that the voices of those impacted by our policy are at the table when we're making it. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I'd like to turn it over to Ben Johnson very quickly to outline the provisions of House Bill 9 that are under the public safety's jurisdiction.
Very well. Mr. Johnson, from our House nonpartisan legal staff, if you can do a quick walkthrough of that for us, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, members, this is going to be very high level. The provisions that I understand will be considered by the committee are the following. In Article 1, Section 4, which begins at line 3.4, and Section 6, which is at line 4.18, those two sections involve pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. It makes an exception within an existing felony provision. In Article 2, there are multiple sections involving the restoration of voting rights. Those sections are sections 1, 3, 4, 32, 36, and 37. For line references, they begin at the following: 15.26, 17.6, 18.16, 34.20, 37.13, and 38.6. Moving to Article 3, sections 3 and 4. Section 3 begins at line 40.1 and section 4 begins at line 41.17. Please note that those sections, particularly section 3, has now been changed by the author's amendment. Those provisions involve voter intimidation crimes and the exception to the administrative requirement that's in current law. Finally, Mr. Chair, in Article 6, Section 6, Subdivision 2 involves redistricting, and it involves how to count individuals who are incarcerated in the state correctional facilities. And Mr. Chair, that completes the walkthrough.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Appreciate the conciseness and thoroughness of that. Representative Reamon.
With that, I think I'd like to turn it over to Representative Frazier, and then I think we can turn it over to the testifiers, and I believe you have a testifiers list.
I do, yes, thank you. Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reamon, thank you. I'll be really brief because I believe the stories of the testifiers that are here are the most important thing in regards to the voter restoration piece, the Bill 876 that I am carrying as a standalone. As Representative Reamon said, we've got over 50,000 Minnesotan individuals that are on some type of probation or supervised release. They're not incarcerated anymore. They're in their communities. They're working their jobs. They're paying their taxes. They are there helping to take care of their families as best they can. However, we have a representative democracy, and they do not get to participate and have their voices heard to elect representatives in our democracy, in our representative democracy, that reflect their values and their voices and address the issues they want to have addressed. So this bill will give that right back to these individuals. It is long overdue. If we're going to have a representative democracy, we need to actually truly have one that allows people to participate in that representative democracy to elect individuals that they would like to see in those positions, advocating for them on their behalves. With that, Chair, I will yield to the testifiers.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Frazier. We'll begin with Attorney General, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, followed by Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. Attorney General Ellison, welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chairman, ranking member, all members, and let me address Representative Greenman and Frazier. Thank you all for having me here to testify in House File 9. I will be brief. This bill expands the scope of the Attorney General's jurisdiction to include civil investigative and enforcement of regulating voter intimidation, interference, and deceptive practices in elections. Expressly giving the Attorney General's Office civil enforcement will allow us to act swiftly to enforce Minnesota's voter protection laws and protect democracy. It is a provision that could have been useful during this last election. Some of you may have seen in the news that in the middle of October 2020, my office launched an investigation into a Tennessee-based security company, Atlas Aegis, that was recruiting private security guards, armed security guards, people from law enforcement and the military to, quote unquote, guard polling places in Minnesota. They were not asked, they were not needed, but this was happening anyway. After our investigation was initiated, we were able to settle with the company, which is a good thing, and we're able to enter into what we called an assurance of discontinuance. It just means a settlement agreement, where they agreed to, one, not intimidate voters in Minnesota or anywhere and in connection with the election, not provide protective agency services in Minnesota, and to communicate with each and every listserv, job board, and individual to whom it originally sent its request for election security in Minnesota that it was wrong to suggest that the scope of work included, quote, armed protection at the polls, at the election polls. That particular case happened to work out under current law because we were able to settle in such a speedy fashion. However, the law that gave us the authority to investigate that company and seek information about their election interference activity requires giving 20 days to respond. Now, that's a problem because we were within 20 days from the election. So we had to get a court order to shorten the response time to 10 days. Had the companies not cooperated, and I'm glad that they did, or taken a long time to respond, you know, if the court did not give us the order shortening the time, then just waiting on the information that we required would have prevented us from taking action as the election neared. And taking action was critical. We were getting all kind of calls at our call center that people were nervous and afraid. Some people thought they didn't want to show up. It was not a good situation, Mr. Chairman, and we're glad that we acted. But this bill would allow us to act better and more effectively. The proposal before the members today, Mr. Chairman, would result in a clearer path to protecting voters from intimidation and interference and prevent deceptive practices that inhibit participation in a fair and free election. I hope that the committee passes this measure along. I also hope we never have to use this measure at all. So I'm going to stop right there and turn it back to you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Attorney General Ellison. And for the record, I'm glad that the county, that the state attorney general's office acted as well. With that, members, Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Representative Greenman in particular. I'd like to say that I'm in the democracy business, and redemption is good for the democracy business. Today in Minnesota, as you heard from Representative Frazier, we have over 50,000 people who are otherwise eligible to vote, are ineligible because they are currently serving a felony conviction. They have done their time, and in some cases have done no time. There was a suspended prison sentence. They've never been a day in any correctional facility, but they're putting their lives back together. They're out in the community. They're among all the rest of us. They're in our neighborhoods. They're working. They're paying taxes. And yet they have not had their right to vote restored. And we should want all of us, people who have left prison behind, certainly, to feel invested, to feel a sense of ownership and a sense of agency. And one important way to do that is to give them a say in who governs them and how, the same thing that the rest of us have. So restoring the right to vote at the end of a prison term will give real opportunities to those who have left prison behind to become full members of their communities and our society. And it sets an example for their children. You know, all the studies show that kids are a lot more likely to vote, to make democracy a part of their ongoing life habits, to make it something that they do year in and year out, if they came from a family where one or both parents or a guardian or an adult that they trust also voted, also participated in our democracy. And so there's a real risk that under current law, we may be inadvertently disenfranchising an entire generation of young people. So this isn't just good for the ex-offender. It's really good for all of us. And restoring the right to vote, as we've seen over the past several years with versions of this bill, either the standalone or otherwise, it's not a DFL idea. It's not a GOP idea. I'm happy to see that there's growing bipartisan support for this bill here today and nationwide. If North Dakota, if Iowa, if Florida can do this, in some cases by a vote that was over 60%, if they can do it, so can we. It's the right thing to do. Thanks for your time, attention, and consideration, members. And thank you to Representative Greenman and Representative Frazier for your leadership as well.
And thank you for your leadership, Secretary of State Simon. Redemption is good for democracy. I think it's one of the most concise, powerful sentences I've heard today. Thank you. Members, next we'll hear from Eli Darius, who is an individual, a citizen who has been impacted by what we're attempting to address with this bill. And then he'll be followed by Demetria Carter of the Barbershops and Black Congregation Cooperative. Eli Darius, if you can come forward, state your name for the record and give us your testimony. And we're not picking up Mr. Darius at this point. So let me then move quickly over to Demetria Carter. Demetria, if you can come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony. We'd appreciate it. And I do see you in our waiting list.
Yep, I'm here. Can you see and hear me?
Indeed, man. Good to see you.
Okay. Good afternoon, and Chair and Committee, thank you so much for taking the time to listen to my testimony this afternoon. I'm Demetria Carter, and I'm with the BBCC, which is Barbershops and Black Congressional Cooperative, which is a Black organizing arm of Isaiah. And what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit of a story about myself, and I'll start with that. I'm a very proud Minnesotan, and I graduated from McAllister College in St. Paul. And I am a hockey mom, a PTA mom. I'm a Sunday school mom. I'm a neighborhood watch mom. I'm a part-time teacher mom and a full-time working mom. So I have a few little things there that I get involved in. Oh, and I forgot to tell you that I have two kids, and they are the most smart, brightest, best, most well-behaved kids in the whole state of Minnesota. Got that? You can laugh a little bit about that one. and I wanted to tell you that I had a great life. I had a really great life, and I was married. I lived in prestigious West Bloomington. I had a home there, and as far as I knew, my life was a great life, as far as I could see. I had everything going for me, and then all of a sudden, one day, it seemed like my life was on fast forward, and I was running behind it. And then there were the days that my life was on slow motion and I still couldn't catch up with it. And so I didn't know what was happening for me, but I suddenly became very unconscious of everything. And I didn't realize why. I started to do things that I didn't understand. I would get in my car and just drive fast, really fast. And when I would wake up from that driving, I might be in Iowa, I might be in South Dakota. And I didn't understand why. I stopped paying attention to my kids. I stopped paying attention to my home and missing meetings. And I started to steal money from my company. And the more I stole, the easier it got to do that. And I wasn't the person I used to be, and I didn't understand. I argued with everybody, and I didn't care about anybody else. And things got worse and worse. I would continually shop. I bought double items. I didn't know why. I hid them around the house. I didn't tell my husband. He would find things that I bought duplicates of. We didn't know why, and we argued a lot. And when he finally came to me and said he wanted to have a divorce, that's what really broke me. I didn't have any idea why he wanted a divorce. So I went to see my doctor. My doctor said he would send me to a psychiatrist. And I went to the psychiatrist and discovered that I was bipolar. I was manic. I had manic depression. And I was there's one other one. There are three altogether. I don't think I need to name them. Three is plenty when you're having mental health problems. And so he diagnosed those three things, and he said that that was the reason that I was so out of sorts, and that was the reason really that I was basically doing the things that I was doing. So the company caught on to what I was doing, and they pressed charges against me. And when they did that, the court decided that I would have served 79 days in the adult detention center, regardless of what the psychiatrist decided. And so when I finished those 79 days, I came out, and they gave me 10 years of probation. 79 days in the workhouse, and I got 10 years probation. That was devastating to me. I didn't see that as democracy in Minnesota. I had always been involved and understood politics and had 10 years of not being able to vote, not being able to represent my state. I had always been involved in politics in the state and in my country, and the country, that was a whole nother story. But I didn't understand it. It was a very shameful thing for me. And I think the thing we have to fix, and I've spent 10 years trying to work on and work with the state on being able to get my democracy back and getting my vote back. And I don't think people should have to wait 10 years to do that. We owe people who come back and are have served their time the opportunity to have their life back and their vote back. I've waited those 10 years, and I'm here to help represent people who need to be able to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Carter. And by the way, Mac is my alma mater.
Right.
That's right. I'm thinking I graduated way before you, though. So,
but I don't know. I was way back, too.
We'll compare notes. All right. Members, we do have... we do have two other testifiers. I'm going to ask these testifiers to be super brief. I do apologize. Your stories are critically important, just like Ms. Carter's story. So I don't want to disrespect, but I also want to make sure that we get to a vote on this bill so we can keep with your supporting moving forward with us. So we have Ms. Jessica Chase and then Natalie Pollard. Ms. Chase, please state your name for the record and give us a very brief, if you could, testimony.
Yes. Hi. My name is Jessica Chase. Can you guys see me?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Wonderful. I have been a disenfranchised person since 2016 when I pled guilty to a felony offense. I will be on supervision until 2029. Despite serving my imposed sentence, completing all terms of my supervision, and successfully acclimating back into the community, I will be on supervision and not able to vote for another 8 years. I would like this law to change. I'm here today to articulate why allowing those who have served their sentence but are still on some type of supervision should be allowed to vote in order to have their voices heard and be part of the community they're in or returning to. I will never downplay my offense nor argue punishment. I believe anyone who has broken the law and understands the gravity of their past choices will not skirt around the legal system. With that being said, acclimation into community is a huge factor in preventing recidivism. As someone who has felt shunned by the community they live in and understand firsthand how isolative and demoralizing having a felony conviction can be, I trust others in my position have felt the same. We have many rights stripped from our grasp, including our ability to vote. Justice-impacted people are expected to atone for and understand their past mistakes. We are expected to make necessary changes in order to convince our probation officers, the court, and the community that we have changed our actions. While many, including myself, have lived up to those expectations, we still have the cloud of disenfranchisement looming over our heads. Not being able to vote in the communities we live in and support, we are still being ostracized as someone who doesn't matter in the world and someone who is a citizen of the United States. In many ways, I can only speak for myself. I own a home. I have a full-time job, one that I've had for almost 5 years, despite one violation sending me to prison. I live a basic, ordinary, law-abiding life with my animals. I pay taxes, yet I'm under a set of laws that I'm not allowed to vote for or influence. I am required to assimilate into the community, yet it's a community that cannot hear from me or my needs. Letting someone vote who is on supervision or once released or once they've been released from prison would allow that person to feel more welcomed into the community and have more pride in remaining law-abiding. We would feel more loyal to the laws since we would have a say in them through our elected officials. Discrediting one subset of people's voice isn't what our country was founded on, nor what people have been fighting for throughout the years. Not all justice-impacted people are the worst of the worst. We are human. I humbly ask for you to allow someone serving a probation sentence or a parole sentence the right to vote. I ask this regardless of offense. We cannot and should not make exceptions to this allowance based on crime category. Breaking the law, despite what that law is, should not exclude someone from their ability to vote or be part of the community, state, or country. Minnesota has traditionally long supervision sentences, upwards of 20 years, without that person even stepping inside of a jail or a prison. It is my position that if someone feels silenced for a possible 20 years, not able to vote for their needs, their lack of respect for the law in general could potentially be shown through action. This is counterproductive to what people need to not reoffend. If we want our recidivism rate to decrease, we must work to make those guilty of crime feel part of the community by allowing them to vote and advocate for their rights. Voting lets people have their voice heard as human beings and as citizens. For a truly just system, we must include the voices of those who are most marginalized, regardless of past offenses and the time that has passed since those mistakes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chase, for working awfully hard to be a productive citizen again in our society as well. My comments as well as to Ms. Carter and no doubt to Ms. Pollard, who will be following up here. Ms. Pollard, if you can state your name for the record, give us your testimony, and please try to be as concise as you can. The chair would certainly appreciate that. Ms. Pollard.
Absolutely. My name is Natalie Pollard, and I have been directly impacted by the justice system. In 2015, I was convicted. Actually, 2016, I was convicted of second-degree unintentional murder. I am a victim of domestic abuse, and I defended myself against my abuser. I also was pregnant at the time with the abuser's baby and had to give birth incarcerated. And then in that process, I appealed my case, and due to circumstances, my case was reversed because there were errors in the jury instruction. I was released in 2017, and I was on some rules that I had to abide by. Anyway, they wanted to retry me. Ramsey County really wanted to retry me. I ended up taking a plea deal, second degree manslaughter. I took the second degree manslaughter charge. I was on parole for a year. That meant I didn't have to go back to prison. It was time served. So I completed parole in 2019, in June 2019. And since then, when you try to move forward in life, when you have a barrier, when you've never had a criminal history before, no DUIs, maybe a little traffic violation, but it was clear, and you want to have a better life, a future for your children. I'm a mother of six, actually. And trying to go around that no, getting told no all the time, or I'm sorry, or your background is just always this barrier. And it becomes frustrating that something that you want so bad for yourself, for your family, that you can't, because I have to wait. If I wanted to do a pardon extraordinary, to waive the process, the first part I'd have to do is to have the waiting period waived if I wanted to do a pardon extraordinary, which is 10 years. So I'd have to wait 10 years to put in an application. Then, you know, as Ms. Carter said, you know, you have to wait so many years before you can do something. And I was just wondering, like, in a case like mine, not in many other cases as well, not just mine, but couldn't there be some type of reconditioning as far as to see, you know, I'm never going to do anything like that again, you know, in a time of fear, in a time when you didn't have any help, when there was nobody there to help you, but what anybody would have done. And to know and try to show and have my rights restored, just to be able to vote, but to say, hey, I promise this is never going to happen to me again. What is it that I have to do to show that, you know, I'm a law-abiding citizen, and to have my record not define me as, oh, she did this, you know, because no one knows the story. No one knows what happened. And to be able to explain that at a job, or have to do the extra mile, the letter of recommendations, and trying to find a place. Luckily, I was blessed to be able to have an apartment so I can bring my kids. We can spend time together now. That was a struggle. but the hustle and the hardships of having to move that extra mile compared to, you know, someone that doesn't have a felony. You know, like I was hearing about, there are certain criteria of, you know, people who have their records expunged. That disqualifies me, you know. And it's just like, well, what is it that I have to do? What that can help in this process? So something like this, you know what I'm saying, can help someone, or something like this doesn't happen again. And
thank you, Ms. Pollard. Yeah, thank you, and good luck and best wishes in your journey to also be a productive citizen and neighbor in our society. Appreciate your testimony today. Members, we're getting short on time. We do have a number of folks. I'll start with Representative Devadney and ask members to be as concise as possible. Representative Devadney.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I will be very brief. As far as a statement, as far as I know, wasn't probation limited to 5 years recently? So
recently.
Yep. So are we fixing a problem that's not really even a problem anymore?
Representative Devadney, yes, there was administrative action proactively on that issue.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman, you can pipe in, but, you know, we either get to vote on your bill or we don't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say this fixes a problem because the minute that people come out of incarceration, they're able to vote.
Yes, indeed. And that was not addressed by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. That's correct. Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really short, but I want to say we've just heard really moving stories about mental health, redemption, and domestic violence. And I want to thank these women for coming forward and sharing those stories. I can't ask my question, which is totally unrelated, without at least acknowledging that I've heard their stories and their truth and their path. So I want to acknowledge that and then shift the conversation, if you would please indulge me. This question is to Representative Greenman. I'd like to know, in looking at the bill, could you just help me understand why you're including the election officials, the judges, in the voter intimidation provisions of your bill? Thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleburne, and I too agree. I think the whole reason we're here is to center the stories of Minnesotans, and so really grateful for that. And this testimony is in written testimony, but the reason is we've actually heard and had election officials talk about the rising fear that they've felt. The co-president of the League of Minnesota Voters, Women Voters of Duluth, wrote that she was speaking with the clerk, and they're actually making preparations to prepare in 2020 for threats against election officials and vote and election judges. I heard from the counties that they're having, that they hear when they're trying to recruit election judges about the rising fear and rhetoric. And so we thought it's really important that our laws protect those 30,000 Minnesotans all across the state that that show up and help us administer our elections.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Greenman.
Thank you.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman. I just had a quick question. I think somebody mentioned how many people would be impacted who are on parole or probation. Can you just confirm what I heard?
Representative Greenman, I heard from Secretary of State Simon, 50,000 otherwise would be eligible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would also just mention that the notice provision, one of the things that we hear is that folks, even folks who currently have their rights restored, are confused about when they're up papers and when they get them back. I have a story about the expungements I used to do and heard about it all the time. And so I would actually say the impact is far greater than just those 55,000. It probably is hundreds of thousands more who will know that they can vote.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. I've had that experience anecdotally as well, as I've knocked on doors and talked to folks. A lot of confusion, for sure. Representative Long, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much to Representative Greenman for bringing this terrific bill. I just wanted to briefly speak to the provisions that are in common between this bill and my bill, House File 662, which will be moving out of committee today, which deals with the how we deal with incarcerated persons for the purposes of redistricting. And we, I think, have heard compelling testimony many times in this committee to there being racial disparities in our criminal justice system and in who winds up incarcerated and who doesn't. And unfortunately, that also plays out in our representation. And this bill is an opportunity to try to correct that and to count individuals in their last known address so that they are receiving representation as part of the committee, the community that they call home. And I think that's a fairer way to do it. So I just wanted to thank Representative Greenman for including those provisions in her bill. And real briefly, just wanted to note to Representative Novotny's question that the change from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission was not retroactive. So there are individuals, we heard from Jennifer Schroeder, for example, on my probation bill last session, who won't be able to vote until she's 71 because she has a 40-year probation term. She's in her 30s now. And so, you know, these are individuals right now who won't be able to vote even though they've completed their sentence. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long. Representative Johnson, followed by Representative O'Neill.
I will keep it short. I'm just disappointed that we're not going to be actually able to ask the questions we need to on this bill or the next other two bills that we're going to be voting on. I just wanted to correct the record a little bit. People talk about this being a democracy. We are not. We are a constitutional republic, which is a whole lot different than a democracy. I will leave it at that right now. We'll save more of this for on the floor, but I will let Representative O'Neill ask the questions she needs to ask since she keeps getting skipped quite a bit.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I did mention on the floor the other day, referring to our society as a republic, I would argue that Representative O'Neill has asked quite a few questions, and appropriately so, in this committee. Representative O'Neill.
And I would concur. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that these committees are filled with controversial bills and bills that need vetting. So I ask the hard questions. In this particular one, we did not really talk about the point of why it's in our committee, which is that we're adding new crimes. There's also civil penalties that are added, and this isn't in judiciary civil law, but there are some crimes that were added, and I'm looking at my notes, and it looks like what's a little ironic to me is that we're talking about allowing felons to vote, but then we're adding a criminal penalty before the amendment of adding another felony. So I find that curious, to say the least. I see that in this amendment, though, I believe it was reduced from a felony down to a gross misdemeanor. And what's more shocking is that in that amendment, it went from $100,000 fine and a felony added into this bill down to a gross misdemeanor and something that's more in line with a gross misdemeanor. So I was hoping that we'd actually have a conversation about what's in the jurisdiction of this committee more so, which is the criminal penalties that we're adding. I just find it really interesting that we, in this bill, were on one hand allowing felons to vote and then on the other hand creating a new penalty with a felony. But I would also finalize my comments here with the fact that this actually is a very partisan bill. It left the last committee with a completely party line vote. I expected to do the same here. This is not a bipartisan bill. This is not a bill that's been worked with across the aisle, even though that was in the testimony. Again, that is not accurate. And so I would like that to be reflected in the record that this actually is partisan, and there are many reasons why that is partisan, and we don't have the time to go into it because we are over time now. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for calling on me, and I do appreciate that you did call on me this time, and we will have this conversation on the floor.
Mr. Chair, if I could just correct what Representative O'Neill just said, just for the record.
Senator Frazier.
There was Representative Garofalo is signed on to the voter restoration bill, making that bipartisan by my account.
All right, very well.
And Mr. Chair, could I also?
Representative Greenman.
So, Representative Neal, I'm happy to talk about the reason for the amendments. It's actually the good work of working with nonpartisan staff to make sure that it was more modeled on a federal policy, and then as we were working to make sure that it was in line with the 211B, that's where the criminal penalty revisions came on. And I would also just add, and we've talked about this in State of Finance, we had 2.5 hours of debate. This is not a partisan bill. These are nonpartisan voting issues. If you look where the policy comes from, it's, most of them are in 30, 40 states. So I would love to have you as a co-author, but that doesn't make the policy partisan. It makes it actually nonpartisan. So thank you.
So hopefully some opportunities for some continuing conversation among colleagues here as this bill continues to move from committee to committee. Representative Lucero, then we're going to go to a vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I can agree with Representative Greenman's choice in color. I don't agree with the details of the bill. Anyway, I was wondering, Mr. Chair, if the Secretary of State or the AG were still with us.
You're looking to ask a question, I take it. The time, we're probably going to get kicked out of Zoom here really quick. And so I'll see if either of them are here. Why don't you pose your question while we figure out if they're here or not?
Yeah. Well, okay. Unfortunately, that's too bad that they testified and then had to leave. They said, or at least Secretary of State said, quote, I'm in the democracy business, and then he repeatedly said that he's working for our democracy. I just wanted to remind Mr. Chair, the committee, and most importantly to the Attorney General who made the similar comment and to the Secretary of State, we're not a democracy. Our form of government is a constitutional republic. And every day we are in session on the House floor, we pledge our allegiance to the flag, which represents a republic. So for the record, Mr. Chair, I wish the Attorney General and Mr. Secretary of State would be accurate in describing our form of government. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. And, you know, as I told Representative Johnson the other day in the SAFE Act presentation, I did talk about our republic. So even I can learn. With that, members, Representative Greenman, I think it's important we get to a vote here. And so the chair will renew his motion that House File 9, as amended, be referred to the, this is going to Transportation Committee. Very well.
That's right.
The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Aye.
Chair Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Johnson, no. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Representative Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Representative Feist, aye. Representative Grossel?
No.
Representative Grossel, no. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Representative Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Representative Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Lucero, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Representative Mueller, no. Representative Novotny?
Novotny votes no.
Representative Novotny, no. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill votes no.
Representative O'Neill, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Representative Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Poston, no. Representative Raleigh? Representative Raleigh?
He had to leave for another committee.
Thank you. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang, aye. That concludes roll call with 11 ayes, 7 nays.
Very well. On a vote of 11 ayes and 7 nays, House File 9, as amended, is referred to the Committee on Transportation. Thank you, Representative Greenman, and to your testifiers. Members, we have two other bills, and we're out of time. And quite frankly, I'm really worried that we're going to get kicked off of the streaming as much as I'd like to move on these bills. And so we're going to tee these bills up at our next hearing at the very beginning. We'll open up for questions, and then we'll do a quick motion at at that time. So with that, members, until we meet again, which is on Thursday at 1 p.m., this committee stands adjourned.